Graham, good to see you again. Welcome to Yachting USA.
Thank you, Rick.
What a pleasure.
Just the invite.
Yeah, it's good. Well, here we are, it's beginning of February and starting a new year, 2025. So first of all, we're actually at Pier 66. They're newly renovated, amazing facilities that have come together. I would say that Megan Legasse Washington has done a wonderful job of helping us kind of settle in here a little bit. And I've been working now with Tim Marcoux, who is the president of Voltari. Voltari is a manufacturer of some really cool electric boats. They've given us their facility for the evening to have this conversation. And we just want to say thanks, Tim. Looking forward to seeing more about your electric boats and what you guys are doing. The little bit I've seen so far looks like it's groundbreaking. So we'll look forward to more of that in the future. So, Graham, let's do this.
Well, it's my first time here at the new Pier 66, and it's really encouraging what's going to happen here. Fort Lauderdale has not traditionally been a destination. It's been a replenishing port.
Right.
But this is as good as it's going to get anywhere in the world, so they've done a great job, and it's nice to see where this is going.
No, the resort's gorgeous. You know, the face dock, of course, is staying and getting full of the big boats. You can see who's moored out there right now, and that's a good sign of what's to come, I think.
Yeah.
So, no, it's good. It's good. It's good to try to continue with this whole idea that Fort Lauderdale is the yachting capital of the world.
Right.
And it takes a little bit of work to hold that status, to maintain that.
Good to see some of the bigger boats we normally see here. I was surprised to see Lady Mora on the other side of the bridge.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That vessel hardly ever leaves Monaco.
I know. It's the only place I think I've ever seen her is in Monaco.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting to see that size boat here in Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
Not what we're traditionally used to.
Right. I understand Breakthrough is going to come over once she crosses the pond, too. That'll be cool to see that boat here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first hybrid with hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah. Exciting. I'll be excited to see that.
Yeah. No, she's cool. I got a tour. Tristan and I both got a tour of her at Van Lent while we were over in Amsterdam for the Super Yacht Forum.
Oh, very cool.
And wow.
Yeah.
They did an amazing job.
I can only imagine. And look forward to learning more.
Yeah. So let's talk about you. We've been friends for a very, very long time.
Right.
And I've admired your career, and I've watched you as you've watched me kind of navigate this industry, try to figure things out. Not always easy. It's always interesting.
Right.
And I think we both have enjoyed a little bit of a success over the years. And I just want to kind of let people that don't know Graham understand where you've come from, because, you know, this wasn't handed to you on a silver spoon. You've busted your butt to achieve what you've achieved. And your roots go back to, when I say South Africa, not the country of South Africa, but Southern Africa and Zimbabwe, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was born in Rhodesia,
which became
Zimbabwe, with a seafaring family.
Right.
That's how we ended up in that part of the world from work that my great-grandfather and grandfather did in the Royal Navy. And that's how we ended up there as a family. But it was always in my genes to go back to sea. And like most crew, I somewhat stumbled upon it. I didn't know yachting existed until I started traveling around the world.
Right.
Discovered yachting in Newport, Rhode Island. And I asked most crew how they get into it. Most say the same thing. They stumbled, or a friend invited them, or they met somebody in a restaurant or bar. And they thought, this is cool. So that's stumbled into it. And something to talk about a little bit later, because it's quite ironic that certainly everybody I know has gone on to represent some of the most well-known people on the planet on a job that they stumbled into. But I'm very grateful to yachting. I spent 10 years as a chief engineer. I love that. This was my absolute favorite job.
Yeah, I was going to say, you weren't a deckie, you weren't a captain, you were a chief.
I went straight into chief engineer, second engineer, then chief engineer.
Right.
And I was fortunate. Right from day one, I was hired on some of the biggest boats that were in the industry. Again, it was just pure luck. And now as I've spent over 30 years in the industry, I always look back and go, being a crew member is best. It was the best job and the most rewarding job that I've ever had. And I miss it. And I think that's why it's easy for me to be a crew advocate now, because in my heart, I still love the role.
Oh, no question.
In business. So
I've talked to so many mariners who rotate to beach jobs, come ashore. Yeah. And you were talking to them years after they've been off their boats, and I almost to every single one, there's this, wow, I really miss being at sea. I'd love to get back out there.
Absolutely.
You know, there is, and I can say the same thing. I started my seafaring career working offshore for several years, and you know, those sunrises and sunsets and those dog watches and just working on the ocean, something about it.
Yeah. I still love being at sea. So that nothing's changed there. The passion is still there, and I welcome any opportunities I get to do longer voyages. And that's something I'm hopefully in April, if it all works, I'll be doing a trip from Seychelles to Cape Town.
Oh, wow.
With a client who's invited me to go along. So I'm, you know,
nice.
I'm excited.
That's, get back that's, to, that's that what, what a privilege. DNA. What an opportunity for sure.
Yeah. And then in 2000, when my first son was born, I realized that being a seafarer is not going to be great. And being a father, back then there was no rotation. So I wouldn't have much chance to get home. Especially as a chief engineer, the captain's going to get first dibs on the vacation time. So I decided there was time to transition to shore. And as it so happens, the vessel I was working on was sold through Fraser Yachts. And Fraser Yachts offered me a position with them as a technical manager in their quite yacht management was in an infantile stage.
Right.
Essentially, there was bookkeeping and no technical manager at all. The MCA was just beginning to be a word.
The ISM hasn't really come
ISM
in yet.
ISM didn't exist.
Right. So I was going to say, having been a chief on board for those years, it's a natural fit to go into management because you know the boats absolutely. Intimately, yeah. keel to topside, stem to stern, how everything works.
Certainly, as I've grown through yacht management and as we touched on shortly, started my own firm. Chief engineers make really good yacht managers because they respect that the captain is in control.
Yep.
And that they're used to reporting to the captain and not telling the captain what to do.
Yep.
Unless they're going to do something that's going to do harm, and then you stand your ground. And that, I think, makes a good manager.
I would agree.
In my experience, captain managers tend to tell captain operators what to do, but they're not there. They're not looking out the window, so they don't understand.
A little more of this kind of thing, maybe?
And just said, you know, when you're in the engine room, you're not looking out the window either, so you have to trust that the captain knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so
it's
the relationship. The relationship certainly works
mutual
very
respect.
Well. Yeah, and the staff I've had over the years that have been engineers have worked out to be outstanding yacht managers. So.
Wow. So you came aboard, you started with Fraser.
Yeah, Fraser at the time had just signed up Octopus as a new construction for Paul Allen.
Mm-hmm.
That's something never been done before. At the same time, the MCA had introduced licensing for captains. It did not exist for engineers at the time.
Wow.
Which was a tough transition. A few of us will recall that.
So you were involved in the Octopus build?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was tough because they would not, MCA, and at the point, at that time, they were running it. It wasn't through the flag state. The flag state was still catching up. They wouldn't accept anything but commercial licenses. So us yachty guys, you know,
what are you going to do?
They called us your lawnmower mechanics.
So, not a lot of respect in that, is there?
Not a lot. So that was, it also set maybe a bit of a tone for me that this is not working. So I want to get more involved in compliance and regulating and writing regulations.
Right.
To possibly help the people who are currently writing them understand what we do as an industry.
Well, there you go. You're giving back.
Yeah.
Going back to Octopus, I do remember that build. That what was so remarkable, that's where I came into it a little bit, was the tender bay, the actual launching bay for the submarine.
Yeah.
And my company was asked to build a little small gangway to get from the catwalk inside the boat onto the deck of the submarine to get people on and off. And just a tiny little piece of that, but to have the opportunity to come on board and work with that group and see that boat.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was incredible. And the also, we were lucky enough to find outstanding project managers, guys like Steve Jackover, just a legend. So we, you know, really good team. And we all sort of knew each other from the industry, so we were able to work as a team on something that had never been done before.
Yeah, how cool.
That was fascinating.
I think I remember meeting you when you started with IYC. I think that's
correct.
Where our paths crossed really for the first time.
So 2004... I was approached by IOC, which I knew nothing about as a firm, except for the fact that Steve Hudson, who's become a very good friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
His uncle was Wayne Huizinga. And in Fort Lauderdale, if you do good things with the Huizinga family, generally good things happen to you, and that was my experience. It was a pleasure working with them. IYC was a small, it used to be called, it was bought as Italian Yacht Collective, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So the name was changed to International Yacht Collection.
Collection, right.
And built it from one office here in Fort Lauderdale to a global company, and I'm very proud of it.
No, it was a great company. Yeah. I was doing a lot of work with Trinity at the time.
Right.
So that's where that all came in. There's so many of those boats being built, and we supplied almost every one of those builds with our equipment. So needless to say, at every level, we were involved in the organization. And thus, aftermarket, you know, we were also working with IYC. And that's certainly where I'm sure you and I met.
Right. That's how that all evolved. It was while I was working there, Trinity Yachts approached Steve Hudson and the group, Brian Tanzi, who's now moved on to create a very successful company, the Worth Avenue Yachts, done a great job. You know, he's amazing what he does. They approached because they really wanted a yacht management sector to the new construction, feeling that their relationship with the client started to go south about 6 months before delivery, essentially once the crew arrived, who didn't understand what the contract or the deal was. So they wanted an intermediate, and that makes sense.
I mean,
that's something that Benetti had approached me in the past, the same sort of thing. So that all made sense, and that deal was successful, and Trinity Yachts bought.
You were also helping Steve with his build up in Palatka, weren't you?
Correct. In that time, there was no inventory. We could get inventory to other prolific builders like Lazara that was feeding the market here well.
Oh, yeah.
By being able to produce boats relatively quickly at a decent price. But there was nowhere to graduate beyond that if you wanted to build in the U.S. I find it a great shame that companies like Trinity are gone.
Lazara's gone.
Newcastle built an incredible boat. I mean,
they did.
It's still an incredible boat.
Yep.
It's one of the most reliable boats I've ever been involved in.
No, did a lot of work with Kevin up there in his shipyard and a number of builds up there, and they did. I just think they were maybe a little too underscaled, undersized for what they're doing. I'm not sure. I think there is just a little bit of not. They were almost there, but not quite there.
I feel that the industry could maybe pay more attention to supporting companies and keeping them in business. Because Trinity in particular, they were delivering like 2-3 boats a year, and we were all providing services to those yachts.
That's
2 or 3 clients a year, at least in South Florida, that we are not getting anymore. They were growing the industry. So beating them up or not supporting them, at least just allow them to make us a sufficient promise, a profit to stay in businesses. I don't necessarily think it's very short-sighted.
It is way short-sighted. I talk about, in a lot of my podcasts, people follow along will have heard me say this, that when I got in the industry, there was arguably over 45 builders in North America building crew-served yachts. That would be 80, 90 foot and larger, where you'd at least have a captain on board. Over 100 foot boats were built by about 30 or so shipyards in North America. There's 4 left, maybe. And that ties into where I think we've lost some of our culture here in North America with the respect for, the shipyard, the building, the asset that the crew and owners are using and require. So, that's something that I hope we can find a way to reclaim in the future.
Pure coincidence, just yesterday I was clearing out a cupboard and I found a copy of Boat International's from 1999.
Wow.
It was a special edition and it was reviewing all the shipyards.
I would love to see that.
It's very interesting.
I would love to see that.
I mean, it's interesting that Lewison was just talking about getting into the mega yacht business. It was talking. And what I found really interesting is they had the world's top 100 yachts in size. And on the first 27 in size, from the largest to the 27th, every one of those shipyards don't exist anymore.
Wow.
Which is quite sad.
That is really sad.
So 28 was the first shipyard that was
still laying keels.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
sometimes
you have to look back into history to see that what the future might bring.
Right. But, well, if you ever sit with like and I love this group, YPY, Young Professionals in Yachting.
Big supporter.
And I do some mentoring with them, and I think it's an amazing organization. But when I talk to some of these younger guys and gals in the industry, and that comes up in a conversation, they look at me like I'm like I've lost my mind. It's like, how is that possible? And it's like, no, it's real. You know, it's true that you guys can't even conceive of what we had as a boat building culture in North America 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah. So
a little
subject, but it's sad to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
So IYC was, I loved working with those guys.
Good group. They launched a lot of careers.
Very, very good group of people. But in 2011, I had an opportunity to start my own firm. I broke away, and it was again a handshake and a cup of coffee with Felix Zapatas, another legend, and we left on excellent terms.
Good stuff, as it should be. Burn up bridges.
Knowing that I'd become a competitor, and started Fairport in 2011. Fairport was the name of the ship. My great grandfather was a captain.
Remember you tell me that?
So that's a family. It's a long family heritage. So I wanted to use that name for the company. With the concept that we would just do, I actually don't like the word yacht management, which really
it's
comes
again way from, overused.
Again from my background as an engineer, we're support. We're here to keep things going together with
the group. Fairport Yacht Support.
And then that's why I went for Fairport Yacht Support. And that was the mantra. That's we did no brokerage, no charter, so that completely independent.
Yeah.
One of the best, well, the best captain I ever worked under, a guy called Pat O'Brien. Unfortunately, he was killed in a motorcycle accident. But he said to me when I interviewed, he said, as a captain, I run the yacht. And as the chief engineer, you make the yacht run. And together
like
with theirs, I'm not above you, you're not above me. We'll do this as a team. And we he is one of my dearest friends, dearest part of friends, I guess. So I always carry that, is that we're a team. And we'll work with the captain and the rest of the crew.
Right.
And nobody is more important or less important than the other.
No, I would agree with that.
Nobody on the crew at all levels.
It's a team.
Yeah.
It's a group. Yeah. Yeah. It has to work cohesively. So while we're on the subject of yacht management, this is a conversation that comes up a lot. As you know, I dabbled in that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Started JMS's U.S. division. Was happy that we were successful in getting the fleet built and the company on its feet and doing well, and it still is. Good job, Nick. But the challenges are many, and like you said, yacht management is such a catch-all term. What do owners really want? What is the real proper role that you see yacht management when it comes into the relationships between the asset, the owner, the crew?
Really, bottom line is they don't want to be hassled. There's a real bottom line. But there's a lot of elements to that. I think that the honesty, even if it's really bad news, is the absolute key.
Right.
And this is where we are. Most of my clients over the years, time is very important, more important than money. I had a client that used to love using the saying, I don't buy green bananas. give me the program that's going to deliver on the day that I need it.
Right.
I know that Wayne Huizinga Sr. got out of the boat and consequently Junior got into the industry because of delays of the extension on the
Floridian, right?
The XRZ rules, and because it was embarrassing, he had to call his friends and cancel trips.
I heard about that,
and he really did not like that.
I can imagine.
For the most part, my life is much simpler, but I'm booked out for weeks or months ahead. When plans change, it's not just that, it messes a whole bunch of other sequence of events up. So
yeah,
being confident, brave enough to say this is not going to work, or that cheaper quote that you've been shown is from a vendor that I know is not going to deliver on time.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. I tell you, this industry, if I was to be somewhat critical of it, And I try to couch my criticisms just because I'm trying to, you know, promote this industry best I can. But it's never been well respecting the time factor for the independent net worth owner, the guy who's basically writing the checks and setting the expectations. I've seen it in my manufacturing business, and of course I experienced having to make those conversations with clients during the yacht management side of it. You know, it's always that mindset, well, we're only going to be a few days late. Yeah, you don't know what that ripple effect looks like.
Yeah. And I want to go back to the compliance side, but before we lose this train of thought.
Yeah.
What I see as a trend today is yacht managers think their most, or their sole purpose really, is to get things done cheaper. And I am completely opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point in squeezing the vendor until they run out of money and go out of business. How is that serving anybody? It's not serving the warranty of that project. It's not serving the community.
And Graham, I'll tell you that in the owners that I've dealt with, I'm taking the captains out of it and just dealing, you know, when I'm sitting down with an owner and talking about their expectations, what they want, I've never had one come and say, Rick, I want you to deliver the most least expensive, least costly component or service to my program. It's always been, I want the service to work well. I want the product to work well. I've never had an argument about paying for value.
Yep. And things are always in boats and aircraft more expensive than you anticipated. Mm-hmm. I understand it. But as long as you've done your research and you know that you're paying or recommending the right value for money,
right?
It can't possibly serve the reputation of the boat to have things that could be maintained and fixed properly the first time have repetitive problems or get to the stage where the client gets so frustrated because it delays and sells a boat, then surveys badly.
Mm-hmm.
You may have saved a few thousand dollars, but you've probably cost tens, hundreds, millions of dollars in bad surveys. You haven't really delivered fairness to the owner of the boat.
Well, what I've learned is there honestly are two different surveys, and you have to be really specific and careful. You've got a buyer survey and you've got a seller survey.
Right.
And there's two different agendas that are in conflict with each other.
Right.
And most, particularly new owners, new high net worth individuals coming into this space don't understand that. Or the broker wants to get the deal done so they know that if they go for a seller survey, you know, it's going to come across a little more easy.
Yep.
You know, not as much deficiencies found that have to be remedied before closing, that type of thing.
And I see it all the time. It's quite prolific at the moment, and it does sadden me that senior people on board the yacht and managers will make decisions saying we're going to go the cheaper route. The boat's delayed and frustrates the owner, sells the boat, and everybody's out of a job.
Yeah.
So where was the winner here?
No, there was no win.
There was no winner. Whenever I see an owner previous owner on the docks, a lot of previous owners still come to boat shows.
Well, sure.
But why did you get out? It's always that same. It's crew problems is the number one.
Frustrating.
Frustration over that.
Yeah.
It all rolls into this conversation. But it's never because the paint job was $400,000 more than I anticipated. It hurt. It stung. They got over it and they moved on. My son works for Gulfstream Jets up in Savannah. And most clients have a private jet, business jet relationship of some sort. Their motto is, if you've got the money, we've got the time. They're shameless that this is an expensive thing to do.
That's right.
I think that yachting would benefit by
a little mindset.
Well, we're good.
Right.
We offer a brilliant service and it's expensive.
Right.
Yeah. If it's not for you, that's fine.
Right.
Then go somewhere else. Because there is somebody else that wants to do what you want to do and is willing to see the value of doing it right.
No doubt about it. Now, I think something that a lot of people don't understand either is there are not, by proportion, that many wealthy people that are actually active yachtsmen. Doing the numbers of billionaires in the world and millionaires in the world, I think the last statistic I heard was like 6% are actually actively.
Right.
That leaves 94% of high net worth individuals that aren't touching our industry. And when we blow one or two or three or four or five a year out because of bad experiences, whatever, they're hard to replace.
Yeah, well, certainly avoidable experiences with a bit more confidence and honesty, self-confidence. I just want to touch on compliance in the yacht management
Yes,
world,
please.
Because that is an important function that good management does provide.
Right.
I was back around 2001, 2002 was when ISM started to get into the yachting world. And if I wasn't the first, I was certainly the second person to get heavily involved, getting a boat ISM certified, which was paraffin with Cayman Islands at the time. So that was the very first writing of a code, ISM code for yachts.
Right, it came out of commercial.
Yeah, along with the MCA compliance, which LY1. These are all new, and there was working groups, and I was on those working groups. So I can really say with confidence I was on the absolute ground level of what we were trying to achieve with these regulations and how we were going to take it and make it actually work for what we do and make it have a meaningful impact.
Right, right.
And I was really pleased in the first couple of internal audits, speaking to the crew, going, on my last boat, we never did safety drills. We never did it. I like this. I feel good about this.
Sure, you would, wouldn't you?
It's like, wow, this is the good stuff. This is the stuff. Now, most owners either don't know it happens or mostly don't need to know or just assume that it's done. Mm-hmm. And probably the latter is is probably a little more concerning. But the where I'm going with this is that that's an area that has grown and as it should have through experience, but it's also an area that I feel is becoming rubber stamped. And maybe we'll touch on that later, but that's not my opinion. I'm just basing on the fact that we're having a lot of accidents.
Right.
And now we're having a lot of mortalities. And that worries me.
Right.
Most of
it's preventable, too.
Yeah, as a former owner, as you know, I was able to do a successful transaction with Fairport and IGY Marinas, which then a year later was acquired by Marine Max.
Mm-hmm.
The yacht managers carry a lot of liability, and I don't know that's fully understood. And the reason I say that, as the owner of the firm, you really need to understand your liability. Possibly as an employee of a company, even as the most senior employee, that's probably not really keeping you up at night. It's not really your problem at the other day, other than the fact that if all goes south, you'll lose your job. You'll get a job in another couple of days anyway. So.
Right. You're going to bounce.
Yeah, so it's we'll maybe go there. But that's an important role of yacht management, but very, very misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, again, value isn't put on that. So it's hard to get paid what it's worth.
And you're really talking about yacht management, where they're bringing the full suite of services and incorporating the ISM compliance into their whole program.
Yep.
Yes, with their DOCs, with the different flags and all of that.
And the interrelationship between that, your over 500 tons of ISM, under 500 mini ISM, but also your LY3 compliance, along with you're changing jurisdictions every 5 minutes. So no one human could possibly understand all of that. It takes a village.
It does. Absolutely. The resources are out there. There's some, more and more, there's more consolidation of resources and it becomes more reasonable to be able to, you know, be updated on what changes are happening, but you've got to actively be involved in
that. So that's, those two functions that good yacht management, good shore support, provider, those are important functions.
Right.
And when it's done well, you see the programs tick along for years and years. Well, nothing happens. So it's not news. And,
no.
And I, quite frankly, Rick, I've been on the other side of that. As a client go, I've been with you guys for 5 years. You know, I don't understand what you do because everything works.
So, well, that's what we do.
Everything works. Because, and not only that, but you asked us for a five-year budget on a 80-meter boat, which is very difficult
to do.
And at the end of 5 years, we were $200,000 off the budget. Which
it's insane.
I mean, I think the percentage on that is maybe 0.01.
That's crazy. Ridiculous. I mean, that's ridiculous.
But he changed our management companies because said, well, you don't really do anything for me because everything's perfect.
So you had to find out the hard way.
It's hard business. No, luckily not, you know, the exception. But again, not well thought out.
No, I mean, that's...
And somebody in the yachting industry giving that person bad advice.
That never happens. Wow. Well, you know, there's so many rabbit holes here. You touched on something. I want to go down this rabbit hole. We'll come back out of it, but I think it all ties together. Those that are following along, you'll see this, I think, come together towards the end of our conversation. I have had this conversation with a number of individuals that have sat with me in this podcast, and I asked the question: are the current M&As that are happening, all the corporate roll-ups, healthy and good for our industry? I bring it up now because you just mentioned that after IGY acquired Fairport, Marinemax came and picked all of you guys up. And of course, I've had Ken Clinton with Intrepid, and I've had Laura Sherrod with Newcoast, and I've had Bert Faust with IGY in our conversations. And I've had this conversation with everybody there. Looking forward to a conversation with Ken again in the near future.
Amen.
But then, you know, we're watching what's happening with Informa. They've rolled up, and they're pretty much the go-to now with all the shows. That's really, if you're going to do a boat show, it's almost certainly going to be through Informa. OneWater has become pretty big. Safe Harbor has picked up virtually all of the available waterfront properties from Florida all the way through New England now. And, you know, there's a big conversation about how healthy that is for our industry and how secure it has our future. You know, will these waterfront service properties where we're doing refit work and maintenance work and such remain as such, or will they turn into nice real estate developments 10 years from now? And then where do we go when all of a sudden those properties are no longer available? Just reasonable questions. Brunswick Corporation has come in and they've been very active in acquiring businesses, and yet their stock is really suffering right now. And if you're a shareholder in Brunswick, you're asking a lot of hard questions probably. Mm-hmm. So what's your view on what's been going in our industry? And then if you want to, you can talk about your own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happened in the end was not what the plan was, but life's like that. So my original plan with IGY Marine was during COVID. We had that Black Swan event where, a bit like that kids game, you know, the musical chairs. There's not enough chairs, and one kid gets their spine. It was the same with COVID. There was not enough dockage. All the boats stopped on the same day.
Right.
There wasn't enough dockage. I thought, you know, this is an important time for me to strike a deal with a marina company to tell my clients that we're going to get you dockage. You're going to be okay. So of course, stop at the top of the mountain. IGY, no,
of course.
Nobody better. Nobody with small marinas. I believe they had 24, 26 at the time. So we started as a conversation of giving us a preferential deal, but it became clear to both parties pretty quickly that we could do it with anybody, they could do it. So we decided to exchange some money, you know, just go from holding hands to kissing. You know, now we're dating.
There you go.
That year with those folks was fantastic.
I remember you telling me about it.
Tom Akamal as a CEO was just a pleasure. Andrew Farkas as a quick, strong decision maker,
as
the owner, was wonderful. You know, Bert did an outstanding job of putting Fairport into every marina. So we went from essentially a company that had an office in Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach to having an office in every marina if we wanted it with signage. The whole idea was we were going to grow.
You scaled.
We're going to grow.
Absolutely.
We could really get going now. With, again, very, very easy conversations of, Andrew, I need to be able to offer free dockage. It wasn't how much, because here's your budget, go do it. And it was way more than I planned to ask for. You know,
wow.
So, some real tools in the toolbox. That was good. When they contacted me and said that Marinemax has made an offer that, honestly, when you go through the numbers, didn't make sense.
Too good to be true, almost?
Absolutely. I fully support Andrew, did what any sensible businessman would do.
Yeah.
And with I won't say misleading might be too far to stretch, but maybe not enough thought of what they were going to do with these assets.
Right.
So the roll-ups was inevitable. I had felt for quite a while, and I think a lot of people were talking that Wall Street has found yachting, and this is going to happen. And that was in the back of my mind, is rather choose who you dance with than told then who you dance with.
Right, right. Be given a dance card you don't like.
Yeah, exactly. So that was that was all in the back of my mind, and that deal went, we went ahead with that. The industry problem, and this is not, it's an industry problem, privately owned, public trade, doesn't really matter, is that upper level management that understands that how things work in our business is hard to find. And
people like you and I that grew up came from basically in the trenches to a C-level position. Yeah. That's not common like it once was.
Absolutely. And I have been an independent business owner for long enough that I don't think I could be an employee again. The people that are capable of doing this probably think the same as I do. I mean, when I think about my departure from IYC, I had a very safe, clear path ahead of me. But that, why do it for someone else when you can do it for yourself?
Right.
And I believe that most people that are capable of running big organizations think the same way. Why am I doing this for someone else when I can do it for myself? They see all the numbers. They see how it works.
Yep.
They're doing the work anyway, so
why not?
And I think that's really the Achilles heel, is that you roll up, but who's gonna run it?
Right.
Yeah, especially when you see incredible people like Tom McAmore leave. You know, he walked out. Why would you let that man walk out the door?
Right.
As he's saying with Intrepid.
Ken Clinton.
Ken.
Yeah.
Why would you let that man walk out the door?
Right. Well, I think the truth be told, and I like actually being a truth teller on this show, he didn't walk out the door. He was shown the door. And I think what it'll be interesting to see, and I'm on the record saying I'm wanting to get MarineMax on our show to talk about the business and have this conversation, because there's two sides to every coin. And so I'm not here throwing any one corporation under the bus, but having known Ken Clinton and watched his story, how he built Intrepid and created the Intrepid Nation, and then really was, his dismissal was surprising to him, and it was surprising to his clients. And I just wonder what vision existed there, because Intrepid's a niche product. There's a lot of competition for that center console space. And Ken did a good job of making sure every boat coming through his shipyard was as close to perfection as he could pull off. I remember when he walked me through the shipyard before we did our interview, and I saw details I wasn't expecting to see for a small, what I thought, production-built boat. Remarkable. My gut is you take someone like Ken out, because there was Ken and a couple other people in the front office that were let go. You've just reduced your overhead quite a bit. And there's obviously a mindset there's someone else that can do his job. But I don't know that you're going to replace the personality and the energy that created the brand, that created the loyalty to the brand. So it's going to be probably challenging to keep that momentum going in what's right now a downtime in the small boat industry. Not a good time, I think, to have to reinvent.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, my experience was very similar to Kent's.
I'd heard that.
I'll leave that there.
That's fine.
But to me, when you look at a firm that year upon year is growing, and every year is better than the last, and every century of growth was better than the previous, it makes it an attractive acquisition. IGY enjoyed that. Fairport enjoyed that. Intrepid enjoyed it and made it an attractive acquisition. But what was the ingredients that made that happen? And, you take out, if I, I tried to learn how to bake bread. You know, you take out one of the key ingredients.
It doesn't work.
You take out, take out the yeast and it's not going to rise.
And Graham, I've got to tell you, whether it's you, Andrew Farkas, Ken Clinton, these are key innovators. These are key drivers that make a corporation what it is. It's the cultural piece.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because at the end of the day, it's the people.
Yeah.
And what's not really understood at that big corporate level is I have people that have worked for me for 20 years. When they needed the help with that little bit of the mortgage that the bank was saying no to, they got it. When they needed that extra time off, they got it.
Right.
When they wanted, the school was asking for stationery for their kids' class, they got it. That brings you a loyalty that there is no one to ask in these big companies.
Yeah, what do you do?
Nobody, there's you go to the HR department. And like,
No, that's not going to. Nobody's going to risk their.
That's the human element. And that's what gets you loyalty.
Right.
That's what gets people who are having a bad day through going, I'm not leaving here because I get treated well when I need it. Of course, you want to pay people well. You want to give them benefits. I get all that.
Yeah.
Any idiot can do that. You know, but it's the moments.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
I mean, I have staff now that they're unfortunately things came to an end a little bit short at Fairport. So my vision was to grow it hugely with IGY. That's what happened. But their children who are now approaching adulthood, the only people they're parent has worked for is me.
Wow.
That's all they've ever known.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And I'm proud of that.
You should be. I point to Nautical Structures. Bob and I ran that business together, and I was there for 35 years. We had welders and electrical people and assemblers and people in the front office that were with the company for 20, 25, 30 years.
Yep.
How does that happen? You have to treat them like people. You have to have that relationship, that connection. Something interesting that I saw over the holidays, and it happened previously during the summer, Andrew Farkas wrote an open letter to the MarineMax board. I believe there's three or four letters now he's written to the board. They're not getting much press, but the essence is, hey, I don't like where IGY is going under your leadership. I want to buy it back.
Right.
And I think that's really profound where you've got a gentleman who's made the transactional decision to sell, has watched his baby, the business he built that he loves. And it's going in the direction that he completely feels it ought not to be going in. It's not doing as well as it could or should. And he wants to reacquire it. I think that speaks volumes too. Hopefully one day I can get Andrew on this show and we can have that conversation because it's interesting how it ties into the business of yachting and what's happening in these M&As and where we settle out to where things are maybe where they should be or could be.
Well, one of the joys of publicly traded companies is you can have a look at the financials whenever you want to. And you can dig pretty deep. They bury it, but it's if you know what you where to look, you can find it. So you take a company like IGY or Intrepid, year upon year of growth, remove the people who nurtured that and fertilized it, and then it starts to flat line.
Right.
So the new administration's thought pattern is, well, to get financial growth, let's cut costs, let's charge more.
Yeah.
I'd imagine that's what the end result is. You're going to have a lesser product and charge more money, and the cutting the cost is going to come out of the people who build it, salaries and benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a short-term solution for a long-term problem.
That's time will tell, but I know what.
Right.
My crystal ball's clear.
Been in it for a while.
Not even hazy. And that's probably where that will end.
It's
a corporate culture that's
right. Well, and that, you know, that's what I talk about too. It's a corporate culture, and we're not, again, we're not just calling up REMAX. I think when you look at all these big codes that are doing all this M&A, and we live and work in a business, an industry that really was a cottage industry.
Absolutely.
You know, it was mom and pops. You think about Bob Rossioli and what he started, yeah. and you can go right down to Bob Drechter or Frank Dennison or any of these guys that started out family businesses on the water, doing what they love, slowly scaling, and eventually turning into something remarkable. And I think the corporate culture deadens that. That's the part that I'm going to be heartbroken if I get to the day where I'm hanging it all up and stepping away from this amazing industry that I've grown up in and realize that it's no longer anything like that. You know, that would be really sad.
Well, there's enough. I'm not against the corporate world at all. I just have learned through listening to a lot of podcasts that the successful corporate culture has figured that out. Steve Jobs, who Apple's a perfect example, gave him the boot. Apple started to fall apart, brought them back in, came back together again.
There you go.
Is it possible that one person can make a difference? There's the evidence.
I think so.
And there are many, many companies that have their decision makers have figured that out, and they do well.
Yeah.
And the ones who don't do well.
That's right.
And the stock market sees it.
Yeah.
And that's where it is. Right. The numbers, as you said, they speak for themselves.
Yeah, they're right there.
Yeah. It's always assumed in the investor world of America, and I've had to learn this in the last few years, that anything less than a 5% return is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not seeing 5%. It's
unacceptable. No, that's looking at those numbers,
Anything
but.
Yeah.
So this is a good segue into reinvention. I like talking about that because in the last few years, I've gone through several reinventions, and I would tell anybody that that was scary. You know, I was the day I decided to step away from the company I was part of for 35 years to do something different. I was like, am I really doing this? Wow. Yet, you know, I look back and I go, wow, what an opportunity to really learn a lot about yourself, learn about what you want to do, figure out where you sit in the grand scheme of things, and then, you know, make some decisions about where you want to go forward. And you've just done the same thing essentially too. You've left Fairport.
Right.
They've just rebranded. We had enough vision that when things changed for you, you kept the crew piece. And so you have your crew business right now.
Correct.
You want to talk about that a little bit? Because I think PYC is a cool business.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation with you, Graham. I think this is good for the industry to hear it from you.
Professional yacht crew, you know, we're based in Cayman Islands, and there's many, many reasons for that. But the cornerstone was that many of our American clients, most of them, and I understand and endorse this, don't understand the employment of all the different nationalities this group. Don't understand what the commitment means and don't understand international seafarer laws, which are some of the oldest laws in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Seafaring is old.
Yeah.
Probably the oldest but one of professions.
Probably.
Yeah. So these laws and regulations have developed and they change in every country in taxation. So the concept of having a employment company that does it makes sense to me.
Right.
Now, there are others in mostly in the Channel Islands that do employment, but they really are payroll companies.
They write SEA agreements and they...
They're a payroll company.
But
So what I sort of... And I had one of those for a while.
Mm-hmm. I know.
But I felt that, you know, this is not getting into the meat and potatoes because I went back to myself as a crew member. So what did I need? And really... I needed was a sense of security. And the more I've researched it, it's probably the number one thing that every human being wants.
Right, of course.
And that's, I thought, well, if I'm going to be the employer of record and carry that liability, then I'm going to give the crew security. We're about 5 years into it. There's a lot of work to be done there. And
mm-hmm.
You have to sort of take baby steps so that the industry can understand what we're doing. And we're more expensive than everybody else because we're doing something completely different. And there's always going to be some resistance, but we'll get past that.
It's value.
And the whole overall idea is that as a crew member, when you become part of our family, we want you to be part of our family for your entire career.
Wow.
We're happy to invest in you. We're happy to cover costs for training.
That was going to be one of my questions because that comes into the conversation a lot. You become professional crew. There are so many, not just reevaluations and research, but there's additional training and new things coming out there. And, you know, who pays for that? Does the crew member have to come out of his own pocket? How often does the owner say, I'll pay for my crew's training? You know, where does that happen? And so your company kind of takes a look at that.
It's not there yet, but we will be.
Okay.
And by the end of the year, the idea is that the only way you can grow your career is to leave your job. That makes no sense to me at all. We'll cover the costs, we'll cover your time off, but we'll, in return, I want a commitment. And if you break your side of the deal, then you're going to have to reimburse on a prorated base. But you stick around, you're going to get trained, and if the vessel doesn't need the level that you're trained to, we'll move you to another vessel that does need you.
Isn't that flexibility?
So we'll follow your career, and we want you to be part of the team. Along with pension, good medical insurance, including family medical insurance.
Wow.
We'll handle your tax reporting and all that, so you can hand over the right documentation to your accountant without having to muddle through it.
Right, right.
And if you're getting treated unfairly, and it's something we should touch on maybe a little bit later on, because it touches into some of the accidents we're seeing.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that if you're getting treated unfairly, you have a voice, and we're not going to fire you. Well, we're going to investigate it. And if it just happens that you're the right person on the wrong boat, then we're going to find the right boat for you.
I love that.
That's really taking the human side.
Because it's culture. I mean, if those that don't know, but you walk in any one of these boats, even some of the bigger boats. I'll share one exception in a minute. But the crew are confined to pretty small, tight spaces. Mm-hmm. And you're... days are long, and you're working 7 days a week, you know, for the duration of whatever that trip or that charter, whatever that looks like. You've got hours of rest that you're supposed to be allocated, but we all know that doesn't always happen. Yeah. You oftentimes have got a wonderful captain and a great organization, but sometimes you have something less than ideal. And you put all that together, the human factor side of it become real. It becomes a pressure cooker that you're trying to navigate through. And then add to that, you're 19 or 20 and you've just left home, you've left your country, you're in a culture you've never experienced before. Wow. How do you deal with all of that?
Well, even when you're not working, you're working on board a yacht.
Yes.
You know, it's maybe a comparison I'd say is you can be on a transatlantic flight with nobody in that knows how planes fly, but if there's a significant change in the engine noise or a significant change in altitude, every passenger is going to wake up and go, "What's going on?
What's going on?" Right.
As a crew member, you're the same. You know, you may be fast asleep, but there's a change or there's a scraping sound. You're going to go, "You're on." Mm-hmm. You know, even though you're not, you're on.
You turn that all the time.
Yeah, it's
right.
That's not well understood unless you've actually worked as a crew member on a boat. And again, I go back to yacht management, is that if you haven't worked on a boat, you are not in a position to advise an owner of a boat about crew issues.
Right.
You're just simply not.
And, you don't and know I, what you don't not, know.
No, I'd love to be proven wrong, but...
No, I would...
So we touched on that, but I'll share two experiences, one bad, one good.
Okay.
As a crew member. And actually working for a gentleman right there. He wanted to sell the boat, and we were made promises that if the boat sells in a certain amount of time and goes smoothly, we'd be taken care of. So we did. Pat Marine was a surveyor, and they put on their A team, and you know, some some Tom Cornes, who I think is probably the best
Marine surveyor in the world. Tom's got to be the best.
He's a legend.
Yeah.
You know, he was the lead, and I was the chief engineer. So every time he thought something was wrong, I'd say to him, Tom, go look at somewhere else. I'm going to fix it. Come back and don't dare write that down.
So that's collaboration. Yeah, I love it.
Because it's like it was a promise that there was going to be in the next step up. At the end of the day, I remember sitting with the owner, Millwood was a broker, and the captain in the study and going through the whole list and showing. This was a $600,000 worth of deficiencies, but I got it down to $35,000.
Whoa!
Only because we were waiting for the part, which was the sphere for the compass. But the compass actually were running fine, so the boat could sail.
Right, right.
And everybody was thrilled. Great job. Go home. Go take some break. We're going to see you on the next project. Got home. Got a phone call from the yacht manager back then. He said, well, change of heart, we're giving you 2 weeks severance, and we're done with you.
Whoa.
To the whole crew. It wasn't just me. It was the entire crew. It's like, did we not just pay?
You stepped up.
On my own, let alone the rest of the crew, our whole year's salary, not for, just for myself, but the entire crew.
Right, right.
What's the issue here? So that was a bad experience.
That's a bad experience.
Conversely, on another yacht, and for the Homan family, I had a boat called Nemo. Chip Homan is still a dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
He came to us and he said, he has a few $100,000. I'm going to put the boat up for sale. If you all stay, you split it equally. If you leave, you lose your portion. And whoever we hire to replace that person will be told the boat's for sale and they're not eligible for this program. We were motivated. We went through boat shows. Boat shows for crew are tough.
Yeah, I know.
Essentially,
watch them.
You're standing there putting your best foot forward, being criticized on anything that's not right.
Keeping the smile on.
Keeping a smile. Being criticized. And it may not be right, but it may not be right because your yacht manager is not giving you the money to make it right. You're taking responsibility for it.
Right, right.
And your pat on the back at the end of the day is, thank you so much, you're fired. It's insane.
Yeah.
Whereas on the Nemo situation, we knew there was money. We ended up doing 3 or 4 boat shows with a smile on our face. We sold the boat, and the money was split between a few of us. And on top of that, when I got home, surprise, surprise, there was a new car waiting for me in the driveway. And for every crew member.
Wow.
Good owner. Motivated.
No doubt.
We got the price. Everybody was happy. The boat sold quickly.
That's beautiful.
And he got exactly what he was looking for out of everybody was happy. The buyer was happy scenario. So this is what I kind of see.
It's a great
moving
story.
Moving forward with Professional Yacht Club, with PYC, is that as soon as we get wind that a boat's for sale, okay, this is my crew. And granted, they're working your boat, but we need to talk about severance.
Mm-hmm.
We are not going to wait until after survey, because the survey is paid to find problems. The crew are going to get blamed for those problems. The manager's going to go, well, it's the crew, because really what the manager was doing, let's do everything cheap. So it wasn't the crew, it was the manager, but they want the next boat. So they're not going to get, not going to throw themselves under the bus.
Yeah. They did everything they had to do to keep that budget they had given the owner in line to what they promised the budget was going to be, no matter what.
Yeah, even though it was wrong.
Right, and that's exactly.
Good people end up losing their jobs for essentially being a very important part of the wheel of selling a boat. And this is what I explain to clients now, is that a chief engineer in particular could torpedo any sail of any boat.
They know where the...
And, I'm now advocating for crew is if you're not going to be offered a decent severance handshake or a promise of the future,
right,
then let's leave right now. Why put yourself through all this pain and criticism on something that's going to come to an end and you've got to feel pretty bad about yourself?
That's not good.
Right. So let's just call it quits and let's move on as a group, the whole lot of us. Let's move on. And that's when you put it to to the financial decision maker, the logic will come back to them pretty quickly.
I would think so.
On a percentage wise, what is this money you're going to spend more in survey adjustments for sure?
Right,
I guarantee
it on
every single deal,
yep,
without question. This is not a, there's no gray area for me.
No, no doubt about it.
So this is money well spent. Again, it goes back to being honest and giving good advice. And so these are the things that are important to me at PYC.
That's brilliant. And I think it's way necessary. And I hope, without any detrimental effect to your business that others start paying attention to your model and start adopting some of what you're doing here, Graham, because I think it, in scale, the whole industry would greatly benefit by programs like yours.
Yeah, no question about it. If from a yacht business owner's perspective, if you are, I think it's reasonable to say that 95% of the yacht owners get out of the yachting sector because a crew-related experience.
Mm-hmm. It's probably not.
I know that.
Probably
accurate.
Yeah.
So let's go with hyper-conservative. Let's say it's 40%.
Mm-hmm.
40% of people in the yacht owners get out because of something related to crew. That means that every single business in the industry is 40% behind of where they could be. And remember, it's probably closer to 90%, but let's go 40%.
Wow, imagine because, those numbers.
Because you want to retain that business plus the new business that you're getting organically.
That's
anyway.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So why is this an argument? Why, if this is what's going to increase your market share and retain clients, and by the way, we're only talking low multiple, low thousands, $2,000 or $3,000 a month, you know, type of number. Not even. I mean,
right, insignificant.
Less. Low. Why are we having this discussion? Yeah, you fix that, you actually fix your own business, and that's where. I know this will work. It is working.
Mm-hmm.
And we're growing nicely, steadily. I'm happy where the company is.
Right.
I also, and I've geared it up because I know that when it clicks into place, we will end up with, you know, 5,000 or more crew. And we're ready for that.
So let me ask you this question. It's a perfect segue because there's conversations I've been having since the holidays. We recently looked at the build report coming out for 2025, and I think there's 9 boats being built that will deliver in 2025 from 87 meters to 134 meters.
Mm-hmm.
I did some quick math, and it's like, God, you know, that's probably close to 1,000 seats of crew.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't bring into conversation the 70-some boats that are probably going to come into the fleet from the 30 to 70 meter, 75 meter range.
Sure.
That's another 2,000 or 3,000 seats of crew. Do we have crew to fill those seats?
No. And the problem is that for every one gray hair you pull out to grow it, we're at that age. I think we both understand that. How many crew are we losing because they are not getting the basics?
Right.
I'm not talking anything major, just what is right.
Right.
Because the structures are set up again, let's save money, let's do shelters that prevent the crew from being able to explore how to be treated fairly.
Right.
And the job becomes less attractive. And it is...
I would say
right now it's at the all-time less attractive level.
Wow.
And as you mentioned earlier on, you have the hydrogen vessel coming up. That's a complicated piece of machinery. That is not...
No, that's real.
You're not just going down to Home Depot and grabbing somebody off the floor and saying, hey, come be a chief engineer.
Right.
You know, this is complicated stuff. So we're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I will tell you one thing. When I toured that boat, one of the things I was most impressed with, besides the cryogenic hydrogen tanks, those are pretty fucking cool, the crew accommodations. 2 decks of crew accommodations. Each of those crew cabins that accommodated 2 crew looked like small hotel suites.
Mm-hmm.
You could do Pilates on the floor, the amount of space was remarkable. They all opened into large open crew areas for recreation, for dining, and I thought, wow, here you go. They've really taken the time and created living space for crew.
Right.
Bravo, Manland, Devoot, everybody involved with that.
Yeah, that goes back to a few key people. The project manager, the key person there, Ron Chase, who's a longtime season captain, and is brave enough to say his piece and get what he knows is right. So good. It goes back to that same human factor. So, Mr. Senator, if this is what you want to do, this is what has to happen.
Right.
And making that sort of those decisions happen.
So that's a captain at the top of this game that's absolutely got good vision.
You know, when I first met Ron, he was captaining Mercedes, which was, what was that?
That was an Ocean Fast.
Yeah, 120 foot or something.
120, yeah.
Somewhere like
128
that.
128 foot
jet. I was, super proud. Same as Olaf Hinke on the Big Lesson, yeah.
Yeah.
These are guys that I'm the biggest, I'm the best.
I know.
But I know them as captains on 120 footers, but that's why they're so good.
They start and they build a portfolio of experience.
Yeah, and they're competent.
Right. No, and professional.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great segue into what I call right now the lunacy in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
So here's
clever
another
choice.
Well,
I see where you're going.
You know, if you know, right? Christmas Eve down in St. Bart's, and this beautiful HCB ends up on the rocks. 9+ crew members on board the boat. I want to be careful here that I don't express more than I need to or should. But everyone hurt. One young woman flown to Miami, grievously hurt. She's fortunate. She didn't lose her life in that. A captain at the helm, and it's a well-known captain that has spent a lot of time putting himself in social media and making himself the star of the show. And what's interesting, Graham, was coming out of this, and again, I want to be really fair not to throw people under the bus unnecessarily. This is a program that was arguably considered the most successful charter program in the fleet. There's a couple boats in the fleet. This captain had come up and been with the owner for 7 years and gone from boat to next boat to next boat. And I would describe what, looking at the program now, looks to me to be very compartmentalization of the program. Owners kept over here, management, DPA over here, crew here, captain here, and the malfeasance that was apparently going on wasn't well known because of the compartmentalization. How common is that?
There's a lot of elements in that one, and I'm following that one very closely. I managed that program for the previous yacht for a while, and they changed management companies, which was a head scratcher because the yacht that they had at that time was the Newcastle we spoke to. This is a boat that I knew from when it was
from keel up.
Literally, there's a concept in somebody's head. We hadn't even drawn, the pencil to paper yet.
Right.
So I can say, if you say that myself and a guy called Angus McKenzie, who's now running Fairport, is no two humans know that boat better than we do.
Right.
So changing management companies on its own
right.
makes no sense.
Like, yeah, so that's right, like you said. Yeah.
So, okay, so it's a relationship thing. All right, that's fine. It's not fine, but it's a head scratcher.
Mm-hmm.
But where you owner element is, you're taking all your advice from one person.
A lot of trust.
Not really. I mean, would you do that if you were a cancer patient or something? Would you maybe say, there is lives involved.
That's,
mm-hmm. And that's maybe what's lost is that, it's just an expensive piece of equipment. But no, there are human beings living on that boat. And people die.
Mm-hmm.
People get hurt. So there are lives involved. So maybe getting a second opinion.
Right.
Maybe doing a little more research of who's actually here. Did you do a full background check and reference checks of your key decision makers? I'll go back to yacht management on this one. If you do a full reference check, who is this advisor? Have they ever worked on a boat? How can they decide on the best course of action for cylinder head replacement on a diesel engine when they've actually couldn't even find the engine room? So it's just money.
Right.
Now it's just money.
Right.
And plenty of industries have gone down this road.
Does it fall into the category, if it ain't broke, don't fix it? I mean, the program was pretty successful, as I understand.
Yeah, it might. But again, that's the owner. And, if you don't know, you don't know.
Sure.
And I can respect that.
Yeah.
However, there are other parties involved. The flag state has to do annual inspections. The management company has to do internal audits.
That's right.
And
it's an ISM boat.
It's an ISM boat. And if you're going on a boat, and this clearly has come out after the fact, and the complaint procedures is something I'm very keen, I'm a huge proponent on. And it doesn't have to be, somebody's treating me nasty. It could be people falling down these stairs all the time. There's something wrong with the
design
anti-slip
of the stair,
or,
right.
So it doesn't have to be, complaints are good.
Right.
All complaints are good.
Right.
And they have to be done in complete safety. So if you go on a vessel and for 2, 3, 4 years, there's not a single complaint, then you should be going, there's something wrong.
Nothing's that good.
Something's being covered up here.
Right, right.
So there's a failure there.
Yeah.
On the auditing process, there's a failure in that. It'll be interesting to see how the insurance company reacts on this. They will probably pay.
Here's the question. I think it's been established there's alcohol involved in this. It's not just an allegation. I believe it's been established that that's the truth. And does the insurance have to pay if the vessel is being, I'm not talking about the tender, operated in such a way that was reckless endangerment, whatever that looks like? These are big questions that I think, you start pulling things like insurance and insurance coverage and liability and all of that. I think that's the cautionary tale for anybody that's running these programs. We already know it's sometimes difficult to get these vessels underwritten and proper insurance in place. And now you have things like this coming into the question, should the insurance be paid?
Well, it really comes down in my mind to what are people going to do about this? Is this going to be one of those, I don't want to have any mud on my fingers, so I'm not going to touch it?
That's what we're talking about today.
Is it going to come down to the jurisdiction, if the crew decide to hire legal help, which they should?
They have.
If the jurisdiction becomes the U.S., there will be a strong financial penalty on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, in my understanding, is two crew have lifelong injuries. And,
yes.
And they should be compensated for that.
Yes,
for the rest of a dollar number, they'll carry them for the rest of their lives.
Right.
I have no issue with that. And if it was a crew member within PYC, I would fully support that.
Right.
So the question is, will something be done about this? And if it's most likely the insurance company, and I'm not talking about the injuries. The injuries should be paid by the
medical insurance. No question about that. That's
the loss of income while you're unable to work until maximum cure is reached. What maximum cure is, you may not be fixed, but you may be medically as fixed as you can. You should be on full wages till you hit that. Then at that stage, it becomes a decision of a settlement.
Right.
And that settlement number is what I'm referring to now, is that it can be an insured event. But I'd have to look at the underwriters and go, if you pay this, you realize you are now opening the door for many more payments like this, because you're saying that it's okay to do this, and it's not okay.
No, it's not okay. And that, I think, is the segue. The reason I even brought it up is because, not to throw this one incident into the light of day, although I think it's good that we do, but to understand this is just one of many. This does happen again and again. Whether it's programs like this or I don't want to say bad captains, but programs that are run poorly at the expense of crew, I think those are things that need to be identified or understood, or when found, called out.
Well, Rick, I had a similar thing happen when I was a manager on the boat, and almost identical accident. And the owner of that boat now has a much larger one right across from us.
I see it.
So not only did we solve it in an amicable way, without making it a big story, we kept the owner in the business.
I was going to say, kept the owner in.
The captain is that it was, we did some serious work with the captain, is still in the business.
Good.
The crew were well treated medically, and none of them, fortunately, the only difference, had permanent injuries.
Right.
Everything's okay. I'm no angel. I've made mistakes. I get it. You know, so everything's okay. This one's going to be interesting to see if everything's going to be okay, or it's going to try and sweep it under the rug, only because it's high profile. But it's this. People only talk about it because it was a high profile boat in social media. Mm. This is happening all the time.
Do you think that's appropriate, though, that the crew is the star of the show and the social media piece of it? Should this boat? I mean, you see it a lot. I mean, it's, I think, with iPhones and cameras and you know, but this boat actually had a videographer full-time on board to help create social media to help promote the boat for charter. That's unique, I think. And then that begs the question, did that piece of it influence the behaviors that caused the accident that night?
I liked what they were doing. I still like what they were doing. And I think it is the future with a... Doesn't matter what I think. It works.
Yeah.
And I would do that again. What they did, I would encourage a client to do.
On full disclosure, Yachting International Radio and our program are supporting the Unbridled program, doing some social media work. Yeah. So we see it, and we're benefiting from that. I'm asking the question rhetorically because of the circumstances, and you know what. Looking for the best interest, best direction going forward.
Right. So, and referring to that with Unbridled, as you know, I was on a panel there with the captain of this other incident.
Yep.
And I supported them 100% then, and I stand behind that. I still do. I think it's good. And it's going to happen. And social media is here to stay in the industry more than ever, thanks to Starlink.
Yeah.
We could, up until Starlink, we could throttle the crew's ability to be on social media very easily. That's gone. So when I referred to the incident that I was involved in 12 years ago, whatever, social media wasn't effective
for
us. But now it is. You know?
Yeah.
So, and that's all there is to it. So there has been another explosive incident last week of sexual harassment on social media.
Yeah, I saw that. That was unfortunate because it seemed like that was also swept under the rug.
And wrong. I know the circumstances of that. I mean,
okay, share what you can.
Well, anyway. I mean, a stewardess was raped once, reported, and was raped a second time by the same person.
Wow.
I mean, because it was Atlantic Crossing, she couldn't get off.
Wow.
This is not good stuff.
No, that's dark.
This is not good
stuff. That's so dark.
You know, so, There was a, when there was an accident on a boat, as an industry, we all talked about it, even before social media, there was an investigation, and that investigation was shared, and we learned.
Right.
That's how things work. That's how the aviation works. That's mm-hmm. how the car industry works.
Yep.
That's how
it's the whole human factors piece.
You prevent.
Right.
So every flag state has a responsibility, and every major flag state we're involved in the industry, part of their shipping act is that they will make that public, and that they'll be posted publicly. If you go onto any of their websites now, the last post was in 2023. You're telling me there hasn't been an accident since 2023? What's going on?
Yeah.
Where is... Something's broken here.
Right.
So... The we would talk about it if there was an accident. Now every week it's not even another accident. Now there's deaths. You know, there was a death here in Fort Lauderdale
at LMC a week ago.
Nothing. There's something to be learned from that,
right? I mean, look at every aviation disaster, you get that.
Yeah.
In my commercial or my technical diving world, when we have a fatality, whether it's a deep dive in the ocean or in a cave, there is a report that comes out because the rest of us learn from what's happened. You need that feedback loop to be not only there, but it has to be relevant and has to be not immediate, but soon enough that you're able to figure things out to prevent that problem from reoccurring.
And it took quite a lot of work I, as you know, I sit on a lot of boards.
Yes.
And it's something I think that every senior person in this industry should, should volunteer some time. That's, yeah, I feel strongly about that. But it took a lot to get the industry in general to agree that when it comes to the accident, it needs to be public. And it needs to be written into the into their bylaws, their whatever their act is, whatever department
right,
it
right.
is. And that's done. So the days of saying, well, it's confidential, it's, we're past that stage. This is now how things work. It has not been done.
Right.
So that's a problem for me. But I want to just go back to what we talked about, the owner's involvement.
Please.
Most of these owners have their own form of air transport. My son's mm-hmm. in the aviation business, and I'm really enjoying learning from him. They have a pilot and a co-pilot. They're never going to say, you know what, I trust this person so much that they can fly the plane on their own. Yeah.
Got
a second opinion. Right. Got a co-pilot. And I use this comparison all the time when I was explaining yacht management to clients, is that we're also the co-pilot. Captain is in command, but if the captain's going to fly the aircraft into the mountain, I'm not going in that mountain with it. I'm going to stand and go, we ain't doing this.
Right. We call that cockpit culture in aviation.
Exactly. So if that's how that owner's operating his aircraft, why was he not operating his yacht in the same way? Yes, you've got your one trusted person, flown around the world hundreds of times, never want to say, well, I just got a second opinion just in case.
Just in case.
That, I believe, is one of the key failings right there.
Yep. Can see that.
Yeah.
Can see that for sure.
And it's, you know, I'm doing this quite often now, and I thoroughly enjoy it. I've been asked by clients to come on board, spend a couple of days on board, and just tell them what's the health of my operation.
Well, there you go. You pick up the culture of the crew. You get a sense of things. You can see, feel, smell how people are working with each other. You notice real quick if there's two people that avoid each other at all costs, type of thing.
I think any seasoned person in this industry can walk on a boat and know within, I'd say less than 5 minutes, but let's say 25 minutes. You know if it's a happy boat or not.
That's right.
You can feel it. As
soon as you feel the energy.
You feel it straight away.
Yeah.
So where I'm going with this is, if you're unsure, ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
You invest a couple of $1,000, get somebody to walk on and say, okay, yeah, things are okay and you're making good decisions. So now you have somebody who's gone rogue.
Yeah.
You may love them, but they've gone rogue.
Right.
And this needs to... do with what you want with that information, but that's where you are.
But at least you get the information, right?
And I do get it. When I said that what we were talking about, it's close to my heart. I do have emails to that owner saying, you're going to have a problem.
Wow. You hate to say I told you so, but sometimes, you know, particularly when you get senior people in this industry that have been around long enough and understand well enough, you should pay heed to good advice, you know, because it's usually delivered with the right intentions.
Yeah.
So one last thing, since the last time you and I really sat down and had a conversation, we've gone through an election, we've got a new administration, the government has fundamentally shifted here in the United States. With that, there is a lot of talk now about, you know, immigration, and is it a new day for a crew with our immigration laws and I think it's important to have that voice to kind of disseminate a little bit of reality check, some good information to those who are listening, or those who are listening that can share this with those who need to hear this. What would you advise if you are coming into the United States now on a B-1, B-2, or a B-2, whatever visa that you've been afforded, best practices and what should be looking out for?
So I've seen some of this popping up recently. The laws have not changed.
I didn't think so.
And just changing those laws would be extremely difficult. So there's nothing new. This subject comes up, I'd say, every 7 years seems to be the cycle.
Okay.
Where it becomes a hot topic. There are a couple of unbelievably good organizations that can help marine industry of South Florida right now is the best equipped.
Yeah. Talk to Patience there, right?
Yeah, Patience Cohen, and shout out to Patience. We meet with Customs Border Patrol all the time, at least once a year, but often more. They are very well representative, and not only local representatives, but also they'll fly in a few people from Washington, D.C. So the message is always the same. But before I can answer your question, but before I do,
okay.
As part of that, at every Fort Lauderdale Boat Show, MISF hosts a session with Customs Border Patrol where it's free.
Yeah.
Captains are strongly encouraged to come. Senior crewmen are strongly encouraged to come. You can ask any question in a safe environment. Year by year, our turnout's gotten smaller and smaller.
Really?
To the point where it's probably 10 people who are there every time who know the answers and the questions already.
Wow, why is that?
I don't know. Because maybe, again, I'm going to go back to this, the health and the mindset of the industry. If you really care about this industry, really care, and this is the stuff that hurts this business.
Right.
Why are you sponsoring a golf tournament on the same day?
Uh-huh.
Are you not seeing the whole picture here?
Right.
Yeah, it's so tempting. Go play golf, drink free beer, have a blast, or sit in a seminar where I could actually become more intelligent.
Ow.
Don't offer it. And if you really care about your career, what's more important?
That's right.
Go listen. Get educated.
Right.
It's free. It's
yeah.
available. And you're going to walk away, most importantly, with the cell number of the 12 key officers of Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Palm Beach, who all pick up the phone. They never have not picked up the phone with me. And we'll act and we'll answer the question and we'll solve the problem.
That's a resource.
Fully available to you. Anytime,
wow.
Anytime. So so the right visa to have is a B1, B2 visa. When you apply for the B1, B2 visa, you can also ask for a C1D and it's free.
Okay.
So you may as well get it.
What does that do for you?
So the C1D visa is intended for more the cruise ship type industry where you're coming in for a couple of days, a couple of hours, and you're out. The maximum stay is 28 days.
Okay.
So it's not the right visa if you're on board a yacht.
Right, right.
But by having both visas, for the immigration officer, you avoid confusion. The immigration officers at most airports are generally at a different phase, a new phase of their career. Always fly into an airport that is used to dealing with seafarers.
Fort Lauderdale.
Miami, Atlanta, New York.
Right.
If you fly through some obscure airport in Minnesota, you're going to have an officer who doesn't know the right answer.
Sure.
It's not trained. And the difference of flight tickets is probably $150.
Right.
So
make sure you get the right airport.
Get the right.
Good advice.
Go to the right airport. Have with you documentation. Do this when you also apply for your visa that shows that you have a real intent to live where you're from or from in another country. The most effective way, and this is right from the mouth of the immigration officers, is a utility bill. Most crew don't have a home of their own. Go to your parents, go to your uncle, go to your friends, say, could you please put your utility bill in my name? They can carry on paying it.
Right.
Now you have a utility bill that says you live somewhere.
Right.
That is, in an immigration world, that is 100% proof.
That's and golden.
That's the end of the story. They will not look further than that.
Okay.
Good advice, and I'll cite an example, is look at your social media really carefully. So the last real case we had, and Patience Cohen worked on this when I got involved, a crew member was turned away, and it just seemed wrong. The B1, B2 visa was right. He had all the right documentation with him. Customs Border Control could open up your social media. So, you know, Instagram, you say, follow, request to follow.
Right.
They don't have to do that.
They just get in.
They get in.
Right.
So, in this case, the crew member said that he was working on the boat and the boat was going to leave. But they went to their social media. And there was a picture of a sold of a house in just off Los Olivos. I just bought a house. And the next post is, look at my cute little puppy that I've just got.
Oh, gosh.
You're living here.
He's settled in.
You're living here.
Right.
So that was, and then, as I, I got nothing. You know, that person's living here.
Right.
So get some sort of believable evidence that you are going to go home.
Right.
And look at your social media as if you were an immigration officer. If you are posting it week after week after week, here I am in Miami, here, and it's carry on for over 6 months or over what your visa was, they're going to see that.
Yeah.
So there is also on the Marine Industry Association website a letter addressing the difference between a B1, B2 visa and a C1D visa that I strongly suggest you print up.
The B2 is purely tourism, right?
B2 purely tourism.
Right. B1 gives you some privileges to work.
Yeah, it's a work visa.
Right.
Now, as long as you're a non-US employer, and we should touch on this is quite important, is how you're getting paid. This has been done poorly in this industry for a long, long time. It is reasonable to expect that if you're being paid by a U.S. entity, company, bank account, that it's believable you're working for a U.S. company, in which case you're no longer eligible. You have to be working for a foreign company. But there's elements to the burden of proof. Are you working at a foreign company or not? The source of your paycheck works against you if you're getting it from a U.S. bank account.
Right.
Be very careful.
Right. So that's where, you know, signing on to a foreign flag boat, getting an SCA from a Cayman or an offshore entity, that all works within the constricts of the B1 visa.
Exactly. And that's, in my case, so with PYC, we intentionally work with Cayman National Bank because it says
Cayman. Yeah. Offshore.
We could get way cheaper wire fees. But again, we're talking $15 a month difference.
Right.
But I'm working ideally on a Cayman boat, but that doesn't really matter. But I'm a Cayman employed company with a paycheck from a Cayman company. He has a letter from the Cayman company saying that I'm an employee. He has the phone number that will be answered in Cayman by one of my employees saying, yes, this person does work on a boat.
You're in.
Building a believable,
right?
As they say, you know, the purpose of Customs Border Patrol in America is to stimulate legal business.
That's right.
Their mantra is to say yes. So give them reasons to say yes.
So let me touch on this one too, because I know when I was doing my JMS work, we had a lot of foreign nationals coming into our office right off of 17th Street, and soliciting, looking for work. There's some pretty strong restrictions, as I understand it, coming into the country and then soliciting for work. Explain how that works and what you should or shouldn't do. I think that's important for people to hear.
All right. So first of all, I want to just go back to that letter from Marine Industries, because the reason we put that on Marine Industries letterhead, because I actually authored that letter, I'm quite proud of it, is that you are not telling the immigration officer what to do as an individual or as a company. It's an association giving you information.
Right.
So you're not creating an aggressive environment. You're creating a collaborative environment with the immigration officer. So I just want, and it explains it in that letter. So again, that letter's on the website, print it up, have it with you every time you enter the country. So B1, B2 visa, the B1 is for work and the B2 is for extended vacation. So you can stay over 3 months, it's always up to 6 months.
Right, 180 days.
It's 6 months. And obviously the length of the underlying visa. So you have a 10-year B1, B2, a 5-year, a 2-year, and a 1-year. And they're issued based on how believable your story is, but more importantly, how many of those visas the embassy has at the time. They get an allocation.
Okay.
So you want to also talk to other people. It's where social media can be very helpful, where I just got a 10-year visa in Rome. Okay, they've got 10-year visas. They'll go there. If people are saying, I'm in Palmer, I'm only getting 1-year visas, they've run out of the 10 years. So no matter how believable you are,
doesn't matter.
They get an annual allocation once that's gone, it's gone. So just sort of explain
interesting.
That. So B1, B2s. B1 is for work. B2 is so you could stay up to the 6 months. On a B1 and a B2, you can apply for another extension, which will give you an additional 6 months. So your maximum stay is 12 months. There's a misnomer, you have to leave the country after 6 months. That's not true. You can apply for the extension. In our experience, and this is 25 years of doing this, that department is so far behind. The way immigration works in America is once they acknowledge receipt, which is automatic, you're considered approved.
Great.
You will probably get an answer to that request about 3 years from now, long after. So you're fine.
It's okay.
You're fine. You have nothing to worry about. At 12 months, you have to leave. B1 is for work. B2 is for leisure. When you enter the country, look carefully at what you were stamped in as. You could be stamped in as B1 and B2. You can be stamped in as B1 or B2. Or you could be stamped in as B1 conditionally working on vessel X.
Mm.
That all those elements decide what your status is.
Right.
But it's accepted as a B1 with no conditions on it that you can work on foreign vessels. That's when it becomes really gray, because at that stage, should you be looking for work on the docks?
There we go.
It's a 50-50, but you'll probably be 51% in your favor.
Okay.
But if you're walking the docks on a B2 visa or a B1 visa conditionally that you work on that boat and you're looking for work, then you're in the wrong.
There you go.
In the same respect, when a crew member enters on board a vessel, it is the captain's responsibility, and this is something that will start to happen one day and captains will freak out, that if that person leaves, that you report to immigration, that person is no longer a B1 status on board my boat, and please switch them to B2 status.
Oh, boy.
Which they should do. And then in which case, they're not allowed to look for work again. If you wanted to do it by the letter of the law, you would fly them out and say, you're out of here, and it's up to you to re-enter however you want to re-enter.
Yeah, wow. Okay, that's interesting.
That's the right way to do it.
Right.
There is a reporting mechanism for, say, changing from B1 to B2 visa that a captain can do of a fax number, which hasn't worked in over 10 years.
Okay.
So
there
that's
you go.
But it will. You know, this will come around at some point, and people will freak out.
Right. So do you believe that ICE is going to do anything different?
I don't think anything's changed at all.
Good. Good.
There is a stronger presence at boat shows. Ironically, the presence is because they're coming to our Marine Industry Association meeting, and they just happen to be walking
you're
up.
You're just attracting.
They're just walking up the dock.
Right.
They're just walking from where they parked up the dock.
Right, right.
To come and tell you how to do things right.
I love it. I love it.
I am not concerned about that. Most of the information out there is misinformation, especially when you see U.S. Coast Guard and Customs Border Patrol, completely different departments, and do not communicate. If you've ever done a notice of arrival, you'll see they don't communicate.
Yeah.
So this idea that U.S. Coast Guard is boarding our boat because, you know, for immigration purposes, that's not their...
Coast Guard has nothing to do with immigration, right?
So most of the articles, most of the posts I've seen have said they'll go, oh, you're so technically wrong that this whole thing is wrong. And it's nonsense.
Good. Well, this is good. That's good information. Hopefully everybody listening picked up on the nuances here, because there are nuances. This is a nuanced deal, but it's okay. We're all right.
Yeah.
Let's keep working. Let's keep going, crew. So where are we going from here, Graham?
I want to just touch on one more thing about you mentioned Patients Cones and Marine Industry Association. You know, these associations do good work for the industry.
They do.
And it's if you're in doubt as a captain or a purser or anything, call Marine Insurance and ask them. But if they give you advice and you get a successful outcome, which you will, become a member.
Bravo, bravo.
Yeah, $400 a year.
Yeah.
The boat will pay for it.
No doubt about it. Be part of it.
I'm going back to where we started. Support the industry so we can all grow together.
Right.
You know, this sort of take.
Yeah.
It's not going to go back to why are the companies that built the 27 biggest boats on the planet in 1999 all out of business. They weren't supported.
That's true. You know, we didn't do
and
a good job.
And they did not help the owners of those boats, even to this day, because a program with a brand has more value than a program without a brand.
No question about it. No question about it. Well, you'll be pleased to know that the guest that follows you on this show is Phil Purcell of the MIASF.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
Phil,
we'll be talking
shout out
about
to Phil.
This.
He's done an amazing job with that organization. I'm proud to be the treasurer. I'm on the executive committee.
Yes.
We just did the Will You Carry On, and we'll be honored to carry on.
Good,
so,
good.
Shout out
yeah.
to him.
No, this is going to be good stuff. Yeah. Get his voice, and we'll go down those rabbit holes about the association and, you know, how they help the industry. And they're not just helping the big yacht industry. They're helping the mom and pops from down on 84 and all the companies and people that are in this industry right now.
I can safely say that without Phil's leadership at Marine Industries, the lease on the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show would have expired. Bahiamar wants it to expire. PS66 probably does too. And it would no longer be a boat show.
Wow, wouldn't imagine that.
But do they get any support? We have to beg and scrape to get members. Everybody that goes to the boat show should be a member of Marine Industries.
I agree.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
Without Marine Industries, there would not be a boat show.
Right. No, and that's go through almost the organizations. I'm a board member of the ISS, International Super Yacht Society. I've been a board member of the USSA, United States Super Yacht Society. I'm a member of MIASF, IBA, and it's remarkable to me how few people really are participating in these organizations. And these organizations are the lifeblood of our industry.
I'd like to be positive on that. It's just a lack of education, getting the word out, and hopefully,
here we go.
This is what
encouraging
this
it.
Is what's helping it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
kudos to you.
Show up, you know, join them. You know, people ask me all the time, how do you get successful in this industry? I say, show up.
Yeah.
Just, you know, let's be there.
Yeah.
So, and you've been here, and I really appreciate you coming on board.
It was a pleasure chatting to you.
Oh, this is good stuff, Graham. Yeah. It really is. I hope you have an amazing year this year, and I know we'll cross paths a lot in the months to come. Can't wait to hear more from you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Graham, be well. And until the next time, I'm out of here.